All right, there we go. I think we're on. All right, Revelation, literally the end of 11 tonight. I'm going to try to get into 12 and 13, getting to the backside of the quarter. I'll pick up the pace as we try to read Revelation as a story this quarter, not getting bogged down as much in the details and the what ifs, but just what is God trying to convey about what the world is and how it works and what he's up to. And again, things that hopefully we'll appreciate is not so much just a word to suffering Christians under Roman persecution, but really things that help us have a sense of what God may be up to today. Because we don't have a prophet, we don't have John here to say, you know, this problem is, you know, the government, you know, doing this, you know, under Satan's domain. But nonetheless, the way the world worked then is the way the world works now. And that's part of why Revelation can reuse all these old images from the book of Daniel or the book of Ezekiel, or because those were talking about different empires too. I mean, you know, Ezekiel's talking about the Babylonian Empire. Zechariah's talking about the Persian Empire and things going on in that era. And yet those images show back up in Revelation about Rome because this is the way the world is, right? Okay, so last week we spent time really focusing on the interlude, right? That chapter 11 interlude within the seven trumpets. We take the seventh trumpet. I'm suggesting the seventh trumpet is the end of time when the saints finally get that justice they have been looking for. That's why there's that great song of praise that breaks out there towards the end of chapter 11 when the seventh trumpet is sounded. And here the interlude helps us understand why God waits. Remember, the souls under the altar and the fifth seal wanted to know how long, O Lord. And God still doesn't answer that question, but he helps us understand a little bit more about why he waits, why he allows the world to trample his courtyard, so to speak, the courtyard of the temple, right? That was one of the images we saw last week. Why does God let his holy temple, why does he let the courtyard be trampled? And what did we see about that last week? Anybody remember? Very unfamiliar. The whole book is largely unfamiliar, but chapter 11 is extremely unfamiliar. Anybody remember anything for my self-esteem stake?
Wasn't it to give people time to repent?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it, really, you know, right? Because the idea was you had these two witnesses that really aren't any particular prophet. They were a mashup of all sorts of prophets. The idea was, and not that prophecy would even remain ongoing, but just simply the words of the prophets have been given, and even when you point somebody back to the Bible in our own day and time, it's still Elijah, in a sense, who gets to speak, or Zechariah, or Daniel. It's still their words, right? And so their call to repent in their own generation literally reverberates in the word through the ages. And so, yeah, ultimately those two prophets, you know, by the mouth of two or three witnesses, something is established. God wanted witnessing to the world to go on about what he says, the call to repentance. And the world would not listen. And eventually, what would the world do to the two witnesses?
Kill them.
But how effective was the killing? Not very, because what happens?
God breathed life in.
Yeah, that's right.
3.5 days later.
That's right. That true resurrection, which is not just a resuscitation like other stories we read about in the Bible, where maybe, you know, Elijah or Elisha raises somebody back from the dead, or even Jesus raising, say, Lazarus from the dead, because Lazarus is where now again?
Dead.
It wasn't really a resurrection worthy of the term. It was a resuscitation. What's a true resurrection? Raised by the Spirit of God with the power of an indestructible life. To steal language from elsewhere in the New Testament of what God did for Jesus. Can Jesus even die again? No. New Testament makes it very clear death has no power over him now. Whatever kind of life God put into Jesus in the resurrection, he cannot even die again, which is a wondrous thing to even contemplate. Especially when then God says, that's what I'm going to do for you. Not a resuscitation, but a qualitatively different life that death itself cannot even touch. The breath of life, again, into a new human life, as it were. And that's the image in Revelation, pretty powerful. And so at that point then, once the rejection, the resurrection of the witnesses, then at that hour there's a great earthquake, the city falls, people are terrified. And then comes the seventh trumpet. Once, in a sense, God has decided, again, he refuses to answer the when question. But once God has decided enough is enough, enough of the rejection of my testimony, of my witnesses, then I blow the seventh trumpet, and then the end comes. All right, so that's what's going on. Now what happens literally at the very end of chapter 11? We have a scene change. Let's go to new territory here. A scene change. In a sense, up to this point, John, remember back in chapter 4, open door in heaven, come up here. And so John kind of gets to go up in heaven and watch what goes on the earth, right? As seals are broken, as trumpets are blown, he gets to kind of in heaven see what's happening on earth as God works. You with me? Now, scene change, chapter 11, verse 19, really should be the beginning of chapter 12. Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the ark of his covenant was seen with his temple. And there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail. What does that kind of sound like, that scene? What does it remind you of? Anything? Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of back to Exodus 19 when God came down on Sinai, this mashup of... And so what you have when you have this kind of thing is the presence of God in some powerful, extreme way has come when these kinds of things begin to happen. And that would make sense if the temple in heaven itself, where God actually dwells, not the earthly shadow, as Hebrews writer calls it, right? But as John sees the thing itself, God's actual dwelling, the door opens. And evidences of divine presence, begin to shake. What John is seeing now is something different. What John is beginning to see now is the deeper spiritual reality. You say, well, I thought that was pretty deep and spiritual as it was. Even more so, because mostly what John has been seeing up to this point is what's going on earth, right? Judgments on earth dwellers, people don't repent, prophets are sent to wake people up into repentance. He's mostly been watching what goes on earth. Now John begins to just watch what's going on in heaven. Okay? That's the significance of the tabernacle or the temple being opened, the ark, the true ark of the covenant, the actual throne of God being seen, the presence of God manifest in a powerful way. Now John's going to be shown what goes on in heaven itself. You with me? Okay. So he's got a kind of a different perspective, scene change here. And so a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was pregnant. She was crying out in birth pains in the agony of giving birth. So stop right there. Who is this? Anybody want to take a shot? Any numbers give you a hint?
Israel.
Yeah. What's the hint, Adam?
The 12
stars. And remember our biblical numerology? 12 is a number for God's people. And so you have the people of God, the people of God here. And she's pregnant and crying out in birth pains in the agony of giving birth. We'll come up to what she's giving birth of in a second. But yeah, this is the people of God collectively envisioned. And does that make sense? I don't know if you thought about this or not, but think about it now. Old Testament, New Testament. Israel in the Old Testament, even the church in the New Testament, are represented as God's bride. Israel was represented as bride. Remember Hosea, the whole point of the book of Hosea, right? Hosea, go take a woman, who's going to cheat on you, because that's how God feels about his wife Israel. And by the same token, in the New Testament, the church, now the new covenant people of God, are the people of God are often represented as a woman in the Bible, right? Okay, so we've got this woman with 12 stars. We've got the people of God, Israel. And by the way, part of what makes this work as well is they're called Israel in the Old Testament. Is there a sense in which in the New Testament the church is still Israel? Because it's not just about, children of Abraham literally. Okay, we'll do something with that in a sec too. Now verse 3, another sign appears in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon, 7 heads, 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. Who might this be? It's actually told you later in the chapter if you need to look ahead. Who's this guy? Yeah, it's Satan.
What is a diadem?
A royal crown. A royal crown. A royal crown, like what the king would wear. Like what a king would wear. And so what's the significance of describing him this way? Especially, 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 diadems, or royal crowns. What's the significance of describing him this way? What should we take from this image of Satan?
The many faces of Satan?
Well, the many faces of Satan, yeah. So what numbers has he taken to himself? The number... Well, whose number is that? So if he has seven heads, what is he aspiring to or trying to be? Yeah, thinks he's God. And what kind of helps us understand that even more? On those seven heads are... Wait a second. Now, there's already a king in this book, isn't there? There's already somebody who's worthy to rule in this book, isn't there? Who is it? So what's Satan doing with seven crowns on his seven heads? What's he, in a sense, claiming to be then? He's a usurper, or at least trying to be, right? And then the other detail, 10 horns. 10 horns. What does that mean? What's the significance of that? What's a horn represent generally? Not so much for our purposes now. I can see why we might think that. Power, right? Why do we, if there's any Aggies in here, what do we talk about sawing them off? Any Aggies in here? Any UT people in here, what character will elaborate then? No, just kidding. we talk, but no, that's a rare Kleinwood. Or Aggies talk about sawing them off because that's where Bevo's power is. Yeah. Or you go to the zoo and you look at the elephant's tusks a lot of times in the zoo. What have they done? Yeah, that's a way of kind of making the animal a little less dangerous. You with me? 10 horns. What's that saying? A lot of power. Tenfold. Satan is dangerous. And we don't often think about it this way because we're so used to thinking, well, Jesus, you know, Jesus is one, yada, yada. Satan is powerful. Satan is extremely powerful, and he's depicted in the Bible as such. After all, he made short work of Adam and Eve in the garden, didn't he? And we think about power not so much as, you know, the power to just literally beat you up physically, but the power to deceive and lie successfully and very persuasively. You with me? He's extremely dangerous. You know, we saw just 2 horns off a Bevo or some other large steer because 2 horns is dangerous enough. 10 horns? You kidding me? This is somebody not to be trifled with. Extreme power. God may be more powerful, but Satan is no pushover. And the imagery is meant to depict that. He's a usurper. He wants to be God. He wears illegitimate crowns. But don't laugh at him too hard. He's got 10 horns. Not to be messed with. And his tail swept down 1/3 of the stars of heaven and cast them to earth. What do you do with that? We've seen other similar ratios and fractions in the book, right? In fact, ironically, going back to the trumpets, what was the common fraction as a fallout from trumpets effects? It was 1/3. Ah, okay. And so, you know, again, you know, those of you who've been around, you know, the Left Behind series or premillennialism enough, you know, this is where the idea of Satan took 1/3 of the angels with him when he rebelled against God comes from, is this type of a passage. I don't even think it's meant to be taken literally here, you know, as though God's got ratios of angels any more than literally elsewhere in the book. The point is, though, regardless, that a decent number of spiritual beings rebelled with Satan. He may be the most powerful and the most dangerous in many ways. And we get those because we talk about demons and we see them in the Bible, right? We know that there are a number of them. Remember the man, yeah, Legion, that's right, in the Gospels. Remember when Jesus meets the man living in the graves there in the Gadarene region? And Jesus asks the demon, what is his name? And he says, actually, it's there's 2,000, yeah, there's thousands of us in here. And so again, or when Paul talks about in Galatians and Ephesians and Colossians, the principalities, the powers, the authorities, other types of evil spiritual beings in league with Satan. Satan is not alone. And so I don't think the idea is he literally took 1/3 of the angels. The point is Satan has a following of spiritual beings, okay? And so his tail swept down 1/3 of the stars of heaven, cast him to earth. The dragon stood before the woman when she, who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. And who is the male child? Next verse. Who is the male child the woman is giving birth to? Yeah, she gave birth to a male child, but not any male child. one who was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled in the wilderness. Stop right there for a sec. So the entire incarnation event is summarized in verse 5. The child is born and then called up to God. Well, in between, there's quite a bit of story, and it's violent. But I want you to see, because this is part of what this part of Revelation going forward, as we get into chapter 13, chapter 14, all the way into chapter 18, part of what Revelation is trying to get us to see, and this goes a little bit counterintuitive, especially because in our culture, even we as Christians have become more materialistically minded than we ought to be. And that is this, that the unseen realm is every bit as real as this room, these chairs. The spiritual beings are every bit as real as you and you and you and me, okay? Every bit as real. Described in fantastic terms, partially because they're a little bit beyond our comprehension even, and partially because the point of imagery is to convey meaning, certain kinds of meaning. They are every bit as real, however, as you or me. Satan is a real being. I don't think he literally has 7 heads and 10 horns, though I reserve the right to be wrong in the last day. Oops. But we get that this is symbolically speaking, but he's real. Okay? And part of what John wants us to learn to see, remember, this is revelation, this is revealing, this is getting us to look and see differently in the world. What John wants them to understand, wants us to understand, is what goes on in the unseen realm impacts the seen realm, and vice versa. And so Satan, think about it this way. So here you have this image of this dragon who wears crowns, desperate to devour the child of the woman who was destined to rule. What is Satan afraid of from Jesus? If he's destined to rule and Satan wears crowns, is Jesus a threat to Satan's ambition? Yeah. How does Satan, when Jesus is actually literally on earth, how does Satan try to devour him? Does Satan literally show up in the birthing suite at the stable, ready to literally as a dragon devour the baby as he falls from his mother's birthing canal? Is that literally what happened?
He
was mad, but were there literally attempts on Jesus' life? And here's the interesting thing. Have you ever stopped and thought about it this way? Why does Herod want Jesus dead? Does Herod see Jesus on earth as a threat to his earthly rule? Where is this one who's been, they say a king of the Jews has been born. Well, remember Luke's gospel? And Herod was troubled and all Jerusalem with him. Because when Herod gets a little paranoid, people die. That's the history of Herod. And people died this time too. Somebody who saw the birth of the child as a threat to his power. And so Herod is just an earthly manifestation of an even deeper spiritual reality. It wasn't just Herod who literally wants to preserve an earthly crown. Satan sees Jesus. He knows enough about who he is. And Rachel crying for her children, but Satan understands. Doesn't fully understand, otherwise he would not have shot himself in the foot by killing him the way he did eventually. But here's the thing. Verse 5 encapsulates the entire incarnation event. So usually we think of, because we hear trying to devour the child when he was born, we think of Herod, and rightly so. But is that the only time that Jesus' life was at risk on earth? And in one sense, eventually is Jesus killed by those who saw him as a threat to their power? Is that not both by the Jewish leaders and ostensibly why the Romans claimed to have crucified him? Is it not that why he was crucified? Pilate knew, the text tells us in the Gospels, that the Jews were putting Jesus up because of jealousy. He was a threat to their power. And what does Pilate, he's got to give a good reason for why they're killing what he knows is an innocent man. What does Pilate have written above the cross when he crucifies Jesus? A threat to Roman power, theoretically, even though Jesus said, my kingdom's not of this world. He's put to death ultimately because people in power see him as a threat to their own. What happens on earth parallels the deeper spiritual reality of what's happening in heaven. You with me? And so this dragon who wears 7 stolen crowns wants to put the child to death. But the child is caught up to God, and look at what it says next then. Not just caught up to God, but to his throne. Whose throne? God's throne or his own? Both. Why do you have to choose? He reigns. What does Jesus say after the resurrection, just before he ascends back into heaven for the last time? All where? Heaven and earth has been given to me. His reign has been achieved despite the dragon's best efforts. He's caught back up to God and to his throne. However, Satan's not done. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for, oh, and there's another number we've met before, 1,260 days. What are the other equivalents of this number that we've met before? Could be 3.5 years. What other synonyms? Say again? 42 months. What else? Time times in half a time. That's right. And what do all of these, the various ways that this period of time is represented in the book, what do they represent? What do we take away from that? That is always generally a period of testing or trial or suffering that is a form of testing and purifying, right? And so the woman has a place prepared by God in the wilderness for 1,260 days. So is this going to be a vacation in the wilderness, or is the woman going to be under duress even if she is protected by God to a point? She's going to be under duress. The people of God are going to be under duress, even if Jesus was successful in accomplishing his mission. All right. And what does that mean? What does that mean? All right. Well, now another scene change, verse 7, but still overall perspective. John is now being shown what goes on in the spiritual realm that impacts what happens on earth. What's the deeper story here besides what we human beings see with our fleshly eyes? What's really going on? What's the story behind the story? This is the story. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting the dragon. Now, who's Michael? Have we met him before in the Bible? The archangel. Have we met him before in the Bible? Yeah, he shows up other places. Where does he show up? Say again? That was Gabriel. Gabriel comes to Mary. He's mentioned in Jude. That's fair. Okay, let me ask a better question then. Where in the Old Testament does he show up? We've met him before. Anybody remember? Gabriel shows up in the Old Testament too. So does Michael. Anybody remember where? Keep your finger here. Keep your finger here. Go with me. Book of Daniel. All the cool stuff's in Daniel. Book of Daniel chapter 10. Not in our kids' class curriculum. But but Daniel chapter 10. And let's see. I want to pick up in verse 10. No, don't have time. Not going to try to unpack the larger context. But Daniel's having a rough time again because, unlike modern touched by an angel mentality, in the Bible, when you actually run into angels or have visions, it's generally very, very frightening. And so Daniel's having a rough day. And behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said, excuse me. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. And then he said to me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. But why did it take me so long to get here? Well, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. And I was left there with the king of Persia and came to make you understand what is to happen to your people in the latter days, for the visions and days yet to come. Stop right there. Why does the angel take so long getting to Daniel? Because there was a little skirmish and he got held up by some other spiritual being. And the idea is that this being that kind of stands behind the kings of Persia, in other words, there's almost like an angel behind, a bad one, behind the kingdom of Persia. There, and again, if we had more times, in fact, Kenneth's been egging me on to teach it again here. I teach a class on the unseen realm and spiritual beings. There's not as much in the Bible as we would like, but there's more than we often realize. And so we want to say this side of the line of speculation, but there is a lot more going on. The Bible really does say there's an unseen realm that's influencing what's going on in the real world, or I say, better way to put it, is the seen world. It goes all the way back to the book of Deuteronomy, passages we don't read, but there's hints all the way back in Deuteronomy that there are angels. There may not be individual guardian angels, but the nations kind of are manipulated by spiritual beings, for good or for ill. And so Michael comes, because Michael's one of the good guys, right? Michael comes. But look at what he's called in verse 21, to go one step further. Verse 21, for our purposes, what happens in between and what's said in between doesn't matter. But the angel, that this angelic being then says this to Daniel, I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There was none who contends by my side against these other spiritual beings, except Michael. And now what is Michael called? Because the archangel is the angel that seems to be assigned by God to look after God's own people. Which is part of why he's the archangel, the chief of the angels, because he is tasked by God for being, you know, whatever the prince of Persia is, whatever. He is that for God's people.
Called the chief prince.
Yeah. Michael, your prince, i.e. the one who is related to y'all, who looks out for the people of God. And to that, in chapter 12, verse 1, same type of thing. We're in the middle of a vision here, but at that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people. And so another time of deep spiritual trouble for God's people, in the unseen realm, who's going to stand up for them and work to effect some better fortune? Michael, the archangel. Yeah, in the New Testament, he's called the archangel. The Old Testament, he's just identified as the prince of God's people, the angel who is assigned to look out for God's people's interests in the unseen realm as the unseen impacts the seen and vice versa. You with me? And by the way, as we flip back to Revelation now, sidebar. And so what happens in the seen realm affects the unseen realm as well. We don't think about it that way, but what's about to happen now in Revelation helps us see that. So, now there a roar arose in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world, because that's how he's actually so powerful. Now, that's his 10 horns. He is masterfully, demonically, devilishly persuasive in his deceptions, and we fall for it. We'll get into that more as the book develops towards the end. The deceiver of the whole earth, and he was thrown down the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And now I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them night and day before our God. Okay, stop right there for a second. In what sense is Satan the accuser of our brothers, of God's people? In what sense is Satan the accuser? Can you think about old...
Job.
Yeah, that's a great example. And how is Satan the accuser?
Well, he would accuse... He says, yeah, Job is praising you because you made him rich, and you gave him all this blessing, put a hedge around him, and that's why he praises you, but take away everything.
That's right.
And so, much praises he would give.
Exactly. And so, in other words, if Satan's accusation there is, Job's not really righteous, he's just in it for the money. You've made them so blessed. It's just a quid pro quo. You get your worship, God. Job gets his stuff, and that's the only reason Job's in it. And God says, no, take away his stuff and watch. He won't curse me. He'll still, he won't understand. He'll be hurt. He'll be upset, but he won't turn on me. But that was Satan. Satan is the slanderer, the accuser. Passage we're not as familiar with, book of Zechariah. Satan shows up and does the same thing for Joshua. Not Moses' buddy Joshua, but the priest Joshua later in the story, later in the history of the people. And the book of Zechariah shows where Satan shows up and slanders him. But here's the thing. In the sense of Satan saying, we're sinful. God, you can't deal with these people. They're sinful. Does he have a legitimate accusation? Yes. So why now? Why not say in the book of Job, why now is he thrown down? In other words, why now is he no longer allowed to slander the people of God? Why? Any thoughts? Because now the problem's been solved. Now there is no more ground for slander because the problem of human sin has been solved. And so Satan literally has no legal case anymore. Before? Yeah, I mean, now Job's individual character, not so much, but in Job, human beings are sinful. God, you got to hold true to yourself. You can't have anything to do with them. Is that legit? That's legit.
Jesus is our lawyer.
Yep, and by the way, we've been pushing the whole Revelation and 1 John overlapping thought worlds. That's part of how Jesus is identified in 1 John, right? If any of us sins, we have an... Oh, there it is. Yeah, John and 1 John and Revelation are doing a lot of the same stuff, just in different ways. All right. So, this, the accuser is thrown down, and because the salvation and power of the kingdom of God and the authority of his Christ have come. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they love their lives not even unto death. How do you beat Satan at his own game? How did Jesus beat Satan at his own game? He died. And here's the hard truth. This is the happy, clappy Christianity. How do you beat Satan at his own game still? Suffering for righteousness' sake, even unto death. Rarely the case in our time anymore, but suffering for righteousness' sake is still something we generally try to avoid. And we don't like sermons and classes on, and we don't like to be reminded that suffering is not a bug, it's a feature of Christianity if you do it right. Jesus himself warned, beware when all people speak well of you. Because if they were offended at me, they'll at some point be offended at you too. And at some point your family will turn on you or your friends or your neighbors or your co-workers, or if you are what you are supposed to be, as I was what I was supposed to be. And don't forget, Jesus at one point, his own brothers didn't believe him and thought he was crazy. And the way that's written in the Gospels, it looks like maybe even Mary had a period of doubts because she was included in that list. So, he's finally cast down. And they have conquered because they love, the saints have joined in the conquering because they love not their lives even unto death. All Satan can do at the end of the day to really hurt you is kill you. But never forget in the Bible, the power of death is not real power. It's easy to destroy. Anybody can do it. A two-year-old with a gun can accidentally do it. Killing is not power, though we fear it like it is. What's real power in the Bible? Killer of the soul, and even more so, though, the ability to give life. Any of us in this room can become killers if we choose to. Who in this room can actually give life to the dead? So you tell me who's got power. Yet we fear death as though that were the real power. And the Bible says, don't do that. Don't do that. When you love not your life even unto death, you have dehorned the dragon. You have sawn them off. He has nothing left on you. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath because he knows his time is short. Is he done? No, but he's lost and he knows it, which means that for those of us on earth, what does that mean? Is that good news or bad news, actually? Yeah, what does verse 12 say? Is he in a good mood or is he kind of grumpy? No, and what does he understand? He understands he's lost. He knows his time is. And we've used this analogy before, but I think it's a potent one. After D-Day, which should have been very clear and was very clear, we now know to the German leadership that the war was over, they were going to lose. They were pinned in by the Russians on the east and the advancing Allies on the west. It was over and they knew it. But rather than surrendering and sparing countless lives, what did the Germans do? What did the Nazis do? They dug in, they fought tooth and nail. How many more people, not of their own people, but even of others, died because they refused to acknowledge that it was over? What did they do in the concentration? They say in the concentration camps, it's all over. We better just quit this little project. What did they do in the concentration camps? Sped it up. They knew their time was short. That's the mark of evil incarnate, folks. That's the mark of when a demon takes bodily form. I'm joking, but only so far. To destroy simply because you know you've lost. And rather than admit you were wrong, rather than admit you didn't get it right, rather than admit you should just stop now and cut your losses, I will destroy as much as I can in the time I have left. And that is Satan's work in the world to this very day. He is still angry because he knows it's over. Because he didn't get the woman, or didn't get the child when the child was born. The child is now at God's right hand with a rod of iron. He knows his time is short and he's angry. And he's been cast out of heaven. Can't hurt anybody or anything up there anymore. But where has God, for mysterious reasons, known only God, where has God still allowed him to wreak havoc? Our homes, our congregation, our workplaces, our neighborhoods, our cities, our states, our country, our world. And he does. That's what the news is about every night. A dragon who is angry because he knows his time is short and he has lost. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. He can't get the child anymore, right? But the woman who gave birth, and he goes after her. Who's the woman who gave birth? Well, now we brought a little bit more. And there's a sense in which Israel of the flesh fulfilled the prophecies and brought the Messiah into the world. But really, in a sense, we're still that woman still, right? We're still the messianic community. We're the woman now. And so he can't get the child, but can he punish us? Can he take out his anger? It's the old motive of the tragedy of domestic abuse. Blame the woman and take it out on her, and that's what he does, us. But the woman was given two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she will be nourished for time, times, and half time. For however long Satan can harass, she will be nourished. This is an image of the first Israel in the wilderness. Exodus chapter 19, when God first leads Israel out of Egypt, he literally says, I gave you wings like an eagle as I got you out of Egypt, who wanted to destroy you, but failed. Right? What did Pharaoh try to do to Israel 1.0? Genocide. And God saved her from that through a deliverer, ironically through another baby, who was not able to be destroyed. But literally says in Exodus 19, I gave you wings like an eagle, as I bring you out into the wilderness. And was it all fun and games out in the wilderness? No. But did Israel die in the wilderness? Was she purged and punished for her sins? Yes. But Israel as a group survived. And Israel as a group entered the promised land. God got her through despite Pharaoh's efforts with eagle's wings, he says in Exodus 19. And so too now he speaks that same language to the woman on earth who is us now, the church, this version of the woman. That she might fly and be nourished for time and half a times. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. God will, just like God will not allow his witnesses to die before their time, God will not allow the dragon to ultimately destroy his bride, his woman, who has given birth to his beloved son. He won't allow it. And so creation itself, I mean, the point is not to find out literal parallels. It's the idea is just simply, literally, because creation is on God's side, everything's on God's side, so to speak, will not allow this demonic, this devilish attempt to snuff out, to drown, to kill the people of God, to finally destroy the people of God. So then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And so there's a sense in which he cannot destroy the people of God corporately. So what does he do instead? What do you think it means when he says he goes off to destroy the rest of her offspring? What's he talking about? He will not destroy the church collectively. Can't be done. God will protect his bride. But you and I individually? And so, as one person once put it, he has nothing else to do but focus on individual Christians. He's already got the rest of the world. And so on one level, I'll be terrifying that Satan knows who we are and where we're at, and he works on us in great anger and wrath with every intention to destroy us. He gets that he can't destroy the church as the church. Oh, individual congregations may come and go, but the people of God will never cease to exist on earth. That's right. We may get to a point like Elijah, I'm the only one left, and God will say, no, there's still 7,000 out there. You may not know their names or where they're at, but I do. It will never cease to exist on earth until he comes back. But churches can fall, and congregations, individuals can fall away, and therefore all the more vigilance because he intends with whatever time he's got left to destroy us. A dragon with 7 heads and 10 usurped crowns and 10 horns wants to destroy us. How does he do that? This is wisdom. This is the spiritual counterpart of what goes on in this world. Understand the deeper levels of what we face. And so the very last sentence of chapter 12 really is the beginning of the next scene. So what does the dragon do to try to destroy the individual offspring of the woman? He stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And so what's he doing? What's the dragon doing? What's he making? Something that...
Well, it's informing all the people that he's won over are now trying to...
Okay, so something that tries to look like him, with similar ambition. Now, here's what you got to understand. In the Bible, the image of the sea, generally speaking, the image of the sea is one of, you got to go back to their world. We talk about space, the final frontier, and the ancient world was the sea. The sea was the final frontier, right? The sea was where ships sailed off and sometimes never came back, right? You know, all the way back up to, 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean. I mean, the sea was always the realm of chaos, the realm of mystery, the place where things disappeared and never came back, that which was uncontrollable ultimately. And so in ancient Near Eastern minds and imagery, the sea kind of comes to represent the world of chaos, out of control, even out of divine control. Think about it this way. Part of why Jesus stills the sea is not just to show his power of creation, but to show his power over that which to the human mind was the truly uncontrollable thing. And you'll notice in the Gospels, when Jesus stills the sea, what do the disciples say? What sort of man is this that even, the healings were kind of cool. That was nice. But even the wind and the waves obey him. We're way past Elijah level here. And by the way, what was the other great sea miracle Jesus worked besides stilling it? Walking on it. Yeah, Jesus walks on it. As though it were nothing. Great manifestation of control and power over chaos. So in the imagery of the Bible, the sea comes to represent chaos, that which is uncontrollable and beyond human beings. And the sea actually then comes to kind of represent humanity in certain mindsets, other passages. We go back in the Psalms and some other places. When you see something coming out of the sea, it's the idea that the kind of the chaos of human history occasionally produces strong and powerful things like great kings and great empires. And how do we know that what John is seeing the dragon do here is kind of the dragon's control of politics, of earthly political power? Well, look at how he describes it after it has 7 heads and 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. In other words, so it kind of looks like the beast. It's going to be the arm of his power. It's his demonic son. You know, if back in chapter 5 we have the lamb, the son, show up to get the seal, and rule, to get the sealed book and rule that way, this is the satanic counterfeit of how he's going to rule. But this beast is described, I saw, as like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, its mouth was like a lion's mouth. That mashup, does that ring a bell for anybody anywhere else? And it is a mashup. Say again? It's Daniel's four creatures. Daniel chapter 7, when Daniel has a vision. And what are the four creatures clearly made to represent in Daniel's vision? They are to represent the coming of successive empires, right? And so the fact that it's mashed up now, what does that tell us? That we have a mashup here? Super empire, I like that. Whoever said that. Yeah. So part of what's going on here is, while yes, I do believe that historically, originally, part of what Revelation is anticipating is when Rome gets its comeuppance as an empire that harassed the church, right? That would make sense to people who get the 7 letters originally. Part of what this book is also doing is just kind of unleashing how God always works, how it always works. And so there's a sense in which, even down to our own day, is not our own nation's imagery a mashup of ancient empires' imagery? We reuse Greek architecture. We weren't the first to use the eagle. Who was? Rome, yeah. The legions flew the eagle on their standards as they marched around the ancient world. Yeah, we're not the first to march around the world waving eagles. The Rome did it first. We, in our very own imagery, ironically, are a mashup of ancient peoples and ancient ambitions and ancient arrogances. And yes, well, I think most literally, most immediately, that the beast is going to be the Roman Empire through which, and by the way, and Daniel's vision went on to say in the days of that, it was going to be a fearsome beast beyond description, that fourth beast in Daniel's original vision, the Roman Empire. And it was, because the world had never seen anything like Rome. And she turns on God's people. And you do almost wonder sometimes where the world has never seen anything quite like us either. And we literally, not just in the Bible's imagery, but in historical imagery, are a mashup of the peoples that have come before us as we stride the globe. literally, claiming all authority, which is why part of some nations like Putin right now really don't like us very much, because we think we have the right to tell the rest of the world what they can and can't do in their own backyards. We didn't like it when the Soviet Union was messing in Nicaragua back in the 80s, but, you know, Russia doesn't like it when we're telling them what they can and can't do in the Ukraine in their backyard. Well, anyways, the more the world changes, yeah. Anyways, so he calls out of the sea of the chaos of human history. He calls up a beast. It's political power. And what does he do? To it the dragon gave what? And his great authority. It's a means by which he will wreak havoc in the world. Yes, in Romans 13, God intends government to be for great good. But the reality in history is government is generally a means of power towards great evil. Power used towards great evil. It's supposed to, you know, administer justice and be and not bear the sword in vain, but more often than not, in fact, it's the satanic counterpart that we actually have to live under. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. Now, most commentators at that detail try to figure out what to do with that in terms of Rome, you know, the full-blown historical interpretation of the book. And that's fair. There is a theory in which, you know, it was called the Roman, or the Nero Redivivus myth. The idea was that Nero really hadn't died, that he was floating around out there somewhere, and at some point Nero would come back and take the throne back, et cetera, et cetera. And so maybe it was kind of that kind of an idea. You know, we try to figure out which emperors represent the seven heads. I think seven's just seven. I would recommend as one possibility, especially the more idealistic interpretation, that the wounded head that comes back to life just represents the fact that empires keep coming and going, yet what do people keep putting their faith in and worshiping, as is going to be the operative word in the coming chapters? We keep worshiping political power. We keep worshiping earthly power. An empire dies, so to speak. A head is wounded. And yet, what do we do? All these young people running around right now thinking that socialism is going to work this time. They never learn. Oh, but this time the right people will be in charge and it will work. We never learn. And by the way, lest we get too uppity about our own democracy, my favorite quote on democracy is that it's actually the worst form of all government, except for all the others. It's not a good system. It's just we're a screwed up race. The criticisms of democracy to a certain point are legit. It is slow and cumbersome, and in certain respects, depending on your perspective, ineffective, or at least inefficient. But try something else and tell me if that's going to really work out better. You won't live under that. But we never learn. We keep following the beast.
Think about that. If we followed that book, we wouldn't need police. We wouldn't need government.
By the way, and that was part of the wisdom of this nation's founders, despite all the flack they take in modern sophisticated thought. In one of the Federalist Papers, I think it may have been Madison was the one who wrote this particular paper, but if men were angels, we would need no government. One of the marks of the genius of the founders in the documents was they actually believed in the depravity of human nature. And that's why they put so many checks and balances and separations of powers, because they understood power likes to centralize. It's got a gravity about itself. It wants to centralize. That's why we need to disperse it over counties and states, and, you know, and then the federal government, you know, split it all out, and the federal branch and the executive branch and the judicial branch. And they're supposed to fuss and fight with each other. That's the point. They're not all supposed to be on the same side. They're supposed to check each other. There's supposed to be a certain amount of struggle. It's not a bug in our system. It's a feature. It was designed to have friction in it, because if there's friction, power can't centralize. And why do we need all these checks and balances, separations of power? Because you can't trust people with power. That's right. And so that was part of the mark of the genius, was for almost the first time in human history, we had a set of documents in the government designed to recognize the depravity of the people who will wield government power, which is why we want to give each of them as little as possible. And split the different roles, the law-giving role from the executive role, from the judicial. Split those up. No one person or one group gets to have that, because this is what we are. But yet, we keep on worshiping the beast who has a head that comes back to life. It'll be different this time. Oh, it'll be different this time. All right. And the world was impressed, especially with the healed head. The whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they, oh, here's that word that's going to keep on popping up and going to be a problem. Now, they worshiped the dragon. For he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? Patriotism gone too far, folks. There is a limit, and there is a point at which it becomes worship. Nobody worships the dragon knowingly, but everybody in this world just about worships the dragon anyways. The question is, what about you and me? Given his 10 horns, how persuasive and deceptive he is. What about you and me? I fear, again, for how consumed with politics some Christians have become. Don't worship the beast. Exercise your rights as a citizen, sure. Be an informed voter, that's great. Have an opinion, fine. But the obsession I am seeing more and more is worship. You know what people worship when confronted, they get really angry or really sad. Disagree with somebody politically and what happens right now, even in the church. Why do we get so angry? Because we are worshiping the beast. We get more angry with each other over different political opinions than we do over each other's sins, than we do over our spiritual immaturity, maybe even false doctrine that might dwell among us. I haven't seen anybody get upset about any of that in a long time, for the most part. But boy, politics, man, we can't even talk about politics among ourselves anymore, can we, honestly? And why is that? Because we're worshiping the beast. Let the reader understand. All right. He's not done. He's not done. But I am. We'll pick up there next week. He's not done. Keep reading if you want. Read all the way into chapter 14 and 15. And I will see you next week, Lord willing.